Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby, and I'm excited to be joined by Joel Slenning. Joel is the president of Innova People, which is a healthcare and IT staffing agency based in Portland, Oregon. Prior to that, Joel founded, built, and sold Icon Medical Network, which is a national locum tenens provider. Joel's recruiting career actually started in 1999. He's consistently ranked as one of the top producing recruiters in the country. He's an award-winning billing manager. In addition to being a big biller, he's a tech investor and a startup advisor. Welcome, Joel. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, appreciate it.
Fantastic. So our mutual friend Jordan Rayboy calls you a badass. Why do you think he said that?
That's funny. I think Jordan and I go way back. I think we met in 2003.
Okay.
At a Pacesetter, and we were both part of the MRI network, and we went back and forth for years, trading places of number one and number two or number three spot in the MRI network. And I think he uses that phrase affectionately, referring to our competition days back in the MRI network.
Got it. All right. No, that makes sense. So listen, by the way, this is completely unrelated to what we have planned to talk about today. But when I checked out your LinkedIn profile, I noticed you're an investor in a tech company in Halifax, Nova Scotia, which is where I'm originally from. How did based in Portland, end up backing a tech company in the Maritimes in Canada?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you know this, but there is a pretty great little tech startup scene in Halifax, and a family member of mine. I know I spent 6 years in Canada, in Vancouver, British Columbia, during my junior and high school years. My family relocated there, and then a family member got involved in this tech startup and made the pitch. It was just very intriguing. And I had spent a good portion of the last decade plus actually helping local startups, IT startups, in the Portland area, scale through staff, talent acquisition. Mm-hmm. So I got on board, and it's been a wonderful experience. I'm an advisor, and it's potentially leading me to another opportunity as well to get involved in another startup.
Cool. Well, that's awesome. Well, listen, that's exactly what I wanted to talk to you about today is, I mean, there's so many things we could cover, but what I'm particularly interested in is your journey as a, going from a recruiter to then a firm, the founder of a firm, but also then being able to scale that, which is something that not many owners are able to do successfully, is to, go beyond being a producer or perhaps a billing manager with a small team, and to be able to replace their own revenue in the business and get to the point where they can actually step away from the day-to-day to the extent that someone could actually acquire it, that it's not just, the business doesn't rely on them. So could you take me through that journey? Like you started Icon, I think almost, was it about 10 years ago?
Yeah. So it was 2009.
Okay.
It started. Yeah. By myself. Awesome.
And so timing wise, like that was round about the time of the last big recession. What inspired you to like say, I'm going to start my own recruiting firm?
Yeah. Well, I had helped build an MRI office up to pretty reasonable size. And I had built a model on which to operate. And literally, I started this in 2003. And it was, the philosophy was to take people's talents as recruiters, or in the MRI language, an account executive, and surround them with tools to make their job easier and basically make sure that we were utilizing really what they were good at, which was deal making or rain making, you know, however you want to put it, most of the time. So that was where the where that's what they were doing on a regular basis. And I was able to take that from a solo desk of recruiting pharmacists, inpatient pharmacists, and take that desk to, you know, the $1 million level, and then replicate that in different disciplines, that same model, different disciplines in healthcare, and ended up with 35 plus employees and a pretty healthy perm placement business in healthcare. So 2008 came, and healthcare was impacted immensely because of the immense job loss and the things that happen. For some reason I had this crazy notion that I needed to go out on my own in the worst market possible. And that was a little nutty, and I think that one of the things that I realized was that you have to have a very significant foundation as to how and understanding of not only what you're trying to accomplish as a search firm owner, but why specifically you're doing it and how it's going to impact the people that you're going to bring on and what's in it for them. Mm-hmm. So taking that same mentality of bringing in talented people and surrounding themselves with tools and or other talented people to make sure that they were doing, that they were most of the time deal making, making placements, you know, bringing in business in the door. That model is very, very scalable, especially if the compensation plan is right and that you are dedicated to investing time in each of those individuals. Mm-hmm. It can't be just sort of this mill. It's very difficult to get high level producers, you know, just by hiring them based on a criteria, taking them through a training program and putting them on the phone. You know, that just, it doesn't, it that is a very expensive endeavor. And so laying that foundation, having written values for your business, very specific. Here's what we're about. Here are the values of the company. Here is the compensation plan. It's ironclad. There's no questions about it. And it's not going to change. And you'll only benefit the more that you do. A metrics system that has the key metrics that can be tracked and people held accountable to. And then finally, the right tool set. You know, whether it's technology, sourcers, researchers, data entry people, even lead generation folks that are bringing potential leads or even appointment setters for them on the marketing side, a marketing team and or outsource marketing team that's doing the email marketing and things. These are all the key components to ultimately being able to lay the foundation to scale a business. And to ultimately replace your personal production with a multitude of others that are hope that then you are now helping to build up and get them to the $1 million mark or whichever, you know, mark that needs to be.
Amazing.
So it's pretty specific. Yeah.
Well, so makes total sense. I agree 100%. That, of course, doesn't happen overnight. So let's talk through the stages. So you said that when you set out, you have to be really clear on what you're trying to achieve, why you're doing it, and what's in it for the people who are going to come with you on this, you know, and join this enterprise. So what were those answers for you? Like, why were you doing it and what were you trying to achieve?
You know, for me, back in contemplating this and planning this thing in 2008, what I didn't like was being, you know, tied to other pieces of a business that were failing, right? And so as you look at what I personally wanted to do was I was you know, just recently married, expecting a child. And I had aspirations of larger things. And so I set out to build a business that was going to help me achieve those things. But on the flip side, what really drives me every day is being a coach and being able to be a part of other people's successes. That really gets me up in the morning, and getting to be a part of and participate with people and help them do, you know, what I've done a few times over. And maybe watch them do it better than me, or in a unique way, or building that out is really what drives me and sets me going. And so that's what you know got me fired up to get that started.
Fantastic. And did you know going in that you wanted to build to sell, or was that an evolution that took place over time?
You know, the timeline of the sale and all of that is always kind of a mystery. You never really know. But I set out to build a business that could be for sale someday.
Yeah.
So there was no, I didn't set a timeline. I didn't know, you know, what that would be, but tried to manage the business and set the foundation of the business up so that it would be positioned to be attractive to someone at some point. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Awesome. So first, I know this is a long time ago. It's probably pretty hazy, but first 12 months, like, what was that like? You know, your own firm, it's exciting, but scary. You've got a new baby. You know, the economy is still, you know, in recovering, or just not even starting to recover really at that stage. What did you do to make sure that this was going to work?
You know, it was scary because it was so quiet out there in the market. And it's funny too, you know, Jordan Rayboy actually came and stayed with me for like 2 weeks at that time. Came to the house and hung out, and we worked a lot of different things out together. You know, what he's so good at is that just plan driven day.
Yeah.
And, you know, so he was a lot of help to me in sort of making sure that as we set this thing out into motion, you know, what were the activities that needed to happen in order to make sure this was going to work. And it took considerably longer than it did, but it was getting, you know, the basics, getting on the phone, starting to build relationships with people, and, you know, being a new business, you know, I was completely basically by myself. There was not a lot. It was hard to break in, which I found surprising, but I think it was just the market at the time. And so navigating that, you just have to believe that it's going to happen. It's a belief system that this is going to take off eventually. And it was literally just sort of one placement, you know, breathing a sigh of relief, being, oh my gosh, okay, finally, like, here's things happening. And then, you know, having to wait a month or two before the next one happens, you know, and then finally it was kind of like, it took 6 months to really get any sort of consistency, even in how it was going to work, how the day to day was going to work. Because, you know, it's very easy to get caught in the trap of, well, administratively, there's lots to do to set up your business. You know, there's lots of things that you can be putting together. There's lots of, you know, training schedules and all this crap that is meaningless unless you're billing, right? So one of the things that you know, you just had to get up in the morning and focus on was the billing activity. What needs to be done today in order to ensure placements are going to happen tomorrow? And then in the evening, that was your opportunity to work on the business. And you have to be willing to do that. You know, unless you've got an investor or you want to put, you know, $500,000, $1 million aside to cover, the probably 2 to 3 years of production that's going to be required by you. So, you know, that's where that focus has to be. And that's not easy, especially in 2009. It was not easy.
Yeah. You know, so when you're in a firm, you do, and especially as you've described your previous setup, a lot of support systems in place to allow you to focus on just doing deals, right? And then when you go out on your own, all of a sudden you're doing everything yourself, and it can be very distracting and also frustrating to figure out how can I concentrate on the revenue generation stuff, but all these other things still need to happen. Were you like a one person show to begin with, or did you have a team pretty quickly? How did that work out?
So I started off completely by myself with no one. And then about 6 to 8 months in, I think, was the first partner to come on and to start selling in an individual desk way. Mm-hmm. And then about 3 months after that is when we brought on two more like account executive types. But I had within 3 months, I had hired a recruiter in India and was using that as a resource to, you know, build lists and source. Even back then, it wasn't super efficient, but it was efficient enough to try to limit the amount of time that I was spending building that stuff and sort of mining and sourcing, because that is just not an activity that really I should be working on. I should be marketing a candidate or you know, speaking to candidates directly. Absolutely. So I spent the couple hundred dollars a month to make sure that activity was happening every single day.
Awesome. You know, in my coaching group, we encourage our members to definitely, you know, get virtual assistants or even team of virtual assistants as a way of freeing up your focus to concentrate on revenue generating stuff. So most of our VAs are based in the Philippines. My VA, Rachel, who you've exchanged emails with, is Filipino. And it's a great a way of getting support while you build up the cash reserves in order to hire your own employees. Or if you are a solo operator, it's a way of achieving more than one person, you know, increasing your capacity. But it sounds like you hired pretty quickly. What were the trigger points to, because this is a big question I get asked, Joel, is how to decide when to make that first hire or the second hire. You know, what is the criteria to say, now we're ready, let's pull the trigger?
I think it's revenue based. Mm-hmm. And if you are able to basically stock away the cash for a full year salary for a person, and you want to scale your business, then you're ready to hire someone. Okay. You know, unless you're going to borrow the money, and there's nothing wrong with, you know, going and getting $250,000 to build up your business. That's okay too. That's a fast way of doing it. It's a little riskier, but you know, you can also raise the money personally. And that to me is where those trigger points are, is if the revenue's there and it's 12 months worth of it. Mm-hmm. Then that's how you do it. And then you just go one at a time.
Why did you, so talk me through the rationale of the 12 months of the cost of hiring that new person. Why 12 months?
I think that for me, it was always a good, safe number.
Okay.
And we never really experimented with anything else. I mean, when we could see within the budget that there was 12 months worth of revenue that was just going to be got set off to the side, then that was another headcount, you know? Cool. If we were increasing total revenue and the increases, you know, had been booked out long enough to be able to afford that person with, you know, then we would do it.
Did you factor in the fact that not everyone's going to make it? You know, we might have to hire three people to have one that's right for us and that's going to actually produce. Or like, what were your hiring metrics or assumptions there?
Yeah. So we, you know, back then it was very, our model was one at a time. We knew that you weren't necessarily going to find success every time. We did a pretty good job, but if you knew that you could end up in a 90-day period where you had guessed wrong and then you were going to lose that, you know, investment. Yeah. Well, obviously based on the 12-month revenue stream, you were setting that money aside regardless. So you had to reevaluate whether or not it was, you know, productive. So I would look at it like this. Even if we mishired, did the hire produce any sort of first time, you know, interviews? And we would calculate those to see if the, if, you know, we would say in our world, a first time interview would equate to about $4,000 on the average for everyone, you know?
Okay.
And so if we were gaining some of that back, we weren't penalized in a massive way. If we weren't getting any first time sendouts at all, or first time interviews at all, then we were really mishired. We made a big mistake.
Yeah.
So we were very, very, we were also slow to hire and quick to, you know, let go.
Yeah.
But based on those metrics. So sometimes people in the 90-day time frame would make it a little bit longer because they were providing candidates for first-time interviews. And we rarely brought, in fact, it was very rare that we would bring someone into a business development full desk role right away. We always brought them in underneath someone and brought them up. So that support and you know, mentorship happened right out of the gate. Mm-hmm. So great. We were very fortunate. There were very few people that sort of didn't make it, but this certainly did. And you have to have very specific metrics, targets in place for each new hire, and understand if they're not hitting those within 60 days, then you've got a real problem. And, you know, if they're not contributing to that first time interview metric, even within that 60 days, then you probably don't have someone that's going to perform in that role.
This is so critical because, well, let me take a step back and just reflect on a couple of things you've said. So Joel, I think that decision as to whether this is a lifestyle business or you're going to build something is critical because the paths are very different, right? And you decided, you know, early on that we're going to grow this thing, because what it means in practical terms is you're drawing down less from the business to fund your lifestyle, and you're reinvesting, you're putting that money aside in order to fund the growth and make those hires, right? So it means that, you know, that's a different, not everyone's willing to do that. And so that's a different path right there. Now these metrics you talk about are important. I'd like to double click on that, because what I've noticed is that some owners who do have the ambition, they do think that they want to scale. But they either make some bad hiring decisions early on, which suck all their capital that they had set aside. And the double whammy there is time as well, right? Because if you give too much time to your new hire to the detriment of your own production and they don't work out, now you've got a double whammy effect where your overall revenue's down and your costs are up. And then that can be so frustrating that people kind of just give up and go, do you know what? Not worth the hassle. I'm just going to be a solo guy and not worry about it. Make a good income. So how did you set things up to, number one, make sure that this person was going to be right for you guys? And then number two, what were the metrics that allowed you to know that someone was doing was on the right track?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Early on, we totally screwed it up, 10 okay. times over. when I was hiring people, I thought that you could sort of do it, teach these people how to do it, and then just sort of set them and go and say, here you go. And then, and within a year or so of seeing moderate to no success doing that, completely just got rid of it and said, this is ridiculous. How can you measure the contribution of someone who's quote unquote not making placements? So that question I had to solve, and I started to realize that there was key metrics, pieces of the business that were being done by new people, that if we were focused in on that, then we could take advantage of every hire, but hopefully make sure that each hire was going to, that we did our job and is going to ultimately be in a machine that was going to work for them and they're going to produce out of it. So after a couple of years of experimenting with this, you realized that there were very specific numbers that needed to be hit. And to expect a new recruiter to come in and build these huge lists of people and on their own and be productive is just nonsense. It doesn't work. You have to provide this stuff for them. And that's where a lot of the researchers and the sourcers come in. Good data scrubbed into your ATS, building out lists that are set up. You have to set this person up for success. But not only that, you have to have a certain number of phone calls that need to go out every day, certain number of different touches, so emails or whatever it might be. And they have to be connecting with a certain number of people, and they have to be what's available to them. There has to be a certain number of jobs that they can pitch. And you can't have someone go in and work on five different job titles and expect to be successful if they're new. They need to work on five different jobs that are all the same.
Right.
And they will be successful. Bringing a person on board to fill one or two more, to make three or four placements for you in a year is pointless. There's no point. The overhead cost and the time invested does not pay for itself. So if you can get to some basic numbers, at minimum of 45 outbound calls for the day to result in at least 2 to 3 connections where they're pitching one of your jobs. And so because usually for me, it was always sort of this 45 to 3 to 1. So I would, once they really did three times, the job was presented 3 times, you typically got someone to at least to the point to where the account manager could say, yes, let's get this person submitted. Now, then you've got a submission rate that you need to make sure that you're understanding. And that also typically tends to be 3 to 4. In our world, in 4 to 1, a lot of people are like 8, 9, 10, 11 submissions to one right. first time interview. And so you have to scale your metrics accordingly. We're fortunate in sort of healthcare and the niche IT space that we're in that there, it takes a lot less to get what we're doing. But the job level that we work on, the volume is much less. So you have to be very mindful of, so the best way to do this is to take your personal desk and work it backwards to the place from placement to recruiting. What were the metrics to become, have a successful placement? You know, and if you're not tracking the metrics, you're just playing Russian roulette with hiring. I just wouldn't even bother doing it. And if there's, so once you have some measurements in place, then you need to put a month's worth of work in front of someone. So you can't plan a week for them. You have to plan a month for them. So if you don't have the volume in your ATS to at least give them 44 dials, I mean, that's not even that many, but if it's done well, they're going to get connections and it's going to build on itself. Mm-hmm. 44 dials a day for a month, you know, then you're in a position to where you can probably create enough first time sendouts to get your person placement free technically for the first 90 days. Because if you can get at least one first time sendout out of that activity a month, in my world, that's worth at least $5,000 a piece. That $15,000 that I know is ultimately going to be created within the business, you know, I've paid for the training time and the investment I've made into the business, into the person, I'm sorry. Mm. And then you're refining their skill over the course of that 90 days. Now, of course, they're immediately dismissed if they don't create a first time interview. Mm-hmm. Usually that's within the first 60 days, but mm-hmm. You know, there's other things if they're not hitting the daily outbounds that you've set forth too. Of course, that's a reason for dismissal as well. Mm-hmm. But most people, if set up to succeed, do, if they want to. So you really have to make sure that is ready and in place to plop someone in, and you know, take 2 weeks, train them up. And within that 2 week time frame, you get them on the phone starting to track and measure their metric activity, you know, their activity and what it means to the desk specifically. And so you challenge your full desk people with if you want to hire someone, here is what you have to have set up and available to them mm-hmm. in order to be able to be successful. And some will do that and some won't. But if you want to scale your business, that is a replicatable model, regardless of the discipline that you're in, which will produce results. And if you waver on it at all, it just blows apart. You can't do it. This is definitely not you don't scale a business by sort of halfway doing things. You really have to be absolutely all over it and inspecting everything that you expect to happen all the time. And that's where all that stuff comes from.
Awesome. So it's a very thoughtful approach. You're very clear on your metrics. And I love this part about setting people up for success. I think that is one of the keys that you've really nailed that, Joel, because owners, they just throw someone at the deep end and then they wonder why the person's not producing or contributing, and then they're frustrated. But really, it's, you know, they have no one to blame but themselves. They didn't set the person up for success. And even if they did have the talent or the desire to do well, they weren't supporting them correctly. So it sounds like you made a few hires your first year. How did things sort of progress from there in the evolution at Icon?
Well, I'll add one thing.
Yeah.
You know, for owners who are looking to scale, you know, this is more, you're not going to work less because you're hiring. Right. You're going to work right. more.
Yes.
And you have to be prepared for that. It is even more intense So the lifestyle businesses are great. You know, they serve a wonderful purpose for not only the individual contributor, but for the community that they're connecting with. But the impact that a scaled staffing company or search firm has is unreal. But it is a full-time job for the owner, for sure. And there, you know, when you get to 50 million or whatever, you can take a little break if you want, or whatever you're setting out to accomplish, you know, 20 million, whatever it is, 25, 50, but don't stop until you get there. So your question about, you know, like I said, got a few hires, kind of rocky, didn't work that great, let some people go. All of a sudden we sort of hit the stride and we had put this training program in place. I spent the time to hammer it out. I used the crew down at Next Level Exchange for a bunch of information. I worked with them very closely to design a training, model. They were very involved in the first 2 weeks, and then every day we were on, you know, what did you get done? How do you measure it? We would do this thing too that worked really, really effectively. And we would have new employees make 10 phone calls and just track on piece of paper to evaluate what happened every 10. And then I would sit down with them and we'd go through it. You know, and sometimes they would connect with someone and they would have some positive things to say. And they say, oh, the next 10 phone calls were all voicemails, right? Or a couple of numbers weren't correct or whatever it is. It's trying to make everyone very conscious of what their effort was producing. Mm-hmm. And then trying to refine the activity. The activity itself or the model of the activity doesn't need to change. But what you're doing with it can sometimes be changed. And I think that also that as we coached through that in a much more detailed way, that really elevated the level of people. And we brought some seasoned folks into the business that I worked with very closely that, you know, immediately contributed because they knew what they were doing. They bought into what we were doing and they replicated it. And so we just started to take off as a business. I mean, it was incredible what we were capable of doing just in the first couple of years.
Wow. So what was the next stage then? Once you kind of hit your stride, year two, you know, or so, you felt like you had something was replicatable. How did things progress from there? Like what were the kind of key stages in the growth of the business?
Yeah. So there's some pretty simple steps that you need to be planned for. You know, one is it protecting the margin of the business in its early stages and not going too fast. We did that, and I think we made a mistake later on in where we had hit such large numbers and we were doing such intense margin that we got ahead of ourselves. But in the early stages, you know, there's a trigger point to where if you truly want to truly scale, I'm not talking about having $1 million search business or $2 million. Right. I mean, those are great. This is like 20 million plus. That you personally need to be off a desk and or you need to be prepared to hire an operations manager of the business. It's one or the other.
Yeah,
you either are no longer going to be a producer. So if you are the key producer and relationship person, then that's not a wise decision to get yourself off of a desk. Mm-hmm. You need to be looking at hiring an operations manager. And when I see organizations that are scaling at around 35 to 40% growth year over year, that's where it's like, okay, you're in a position to where you've got something going. You can make this thing go even faster. So, but you have to have someone working on the business every single day. And that person, and they're not easy to find, but they're also not impossible to find. If you're going to stay on a desk and you need an operations manager, you need a true operations manager. And I would almost, if you're a permanent placement business, almost recommend looking not in the permanent placement executive search direction, but in the staffing business direction mm-hmm. for an operations manager. Mm-hmm. They are metrics driven. They understand gross profit. They understand how all of the operations of the business can work, and they're probably going to bring efficiencies to the company. If you're sort of an average producer and maybe even have kind of worked yourself off of a desk because your support people are so good, plan on promoting somebody up into your role, easing yourself out of it, and completely cutting yourself off from it, and then work on scaling the business. So bringing people in, you know, constantly looking at the operations of the organization, making sure that it's as efficient as possible and that all the systems are working. This is where you probably want to look at maybe hiring a full-time marketing team, whether you mm-hmm. outsource it, you know, to someone else, or you bring it in-house, that you're in contact with the leader of your sourcing team, whether they're offshore or in-house, but you're working on creating more efficiencies. You're really understanding how the candidate flow is coming into the business. How efficient is it? How good is it? And working on refining that. And continuing to, like we talked early, specifically making sure that your focus is on each producer making their life, quote unquote, easier and bringing efficiencies to that desk level. If you focus in on that, you'll scale like crazy. Your business will just absolutely take off, which is what mine did. It just flew. Went from, I think we did like $50,000 the first year. Mm-hmm. And then we did almost 2 million. The third year it was over 6 million. And by year three, we were well into the 10, 12 range. And I think at best we did 16 or 17 million and kind of hung around there for a while. So it's very, very, very doable. But you have to have someone who is in the weeds day to day, whether it's you or you hire someone to do that. You know, and some people just aren't good at that. You maybe be the firm owner and you're just a piddly producer, and maybe you're not good at the operations and being able to refine processes and dig deep and understand the database and creating, you know, more opportunity for your recruiters. That's okay. Hire somebody to do it, because otherwise your business is not going to grow.
Yeah, absolutely. This is really good stuff, Joel. So, by the way, just so I have the context here, what was the mix of your business in terms of the locums versus, you know, direct hire, permanent placements, and, you know, what did that look like?
Yeah, so I think at our best, we did 11 million in locums and 5.5 million in perm. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like 75-25 right in there.
Do you think it's easier to scale rapidly when you have that the recurring revenue from the contract side of the business? Because then you've got visibility of, you know, future earnings and cash flow, so you can be a little more confident or a little more aggressive in hiring.
Yeah. Yes and no. I would say yes, and that makes it much, the exposure is so much more fluid and solid. Like, you understand you're billing every week, you know, and if you're billing $250,000 a week, then, you know, you know where you stand. Even if you're doing $30,000 a week, you know, like, here's the revenue, here's what my gross profit is. Ultimately, I'm working out my margin, you know, I know what's happening. But I also think that, and this isn't always perfect, but I'm a believer in it. If you're tracking your first time interviews very, very closely and can based on the desk and average fee for that particular desk, you can predict revenue based on first time interviews. And we did that forever. And we weren't 100% accurate with it, but we understood that if you're cooking and you're getting people out and they're interviewing, you're going to be making consistent placements, and you can sort of set a value on each of those first time sendouts and understand, you know, have some predictability to a desk. So there, it's there. But to your point, yes, it is a little tougher.
So Joel, when you reach the kind of the pinnacle in terms of revenue, what was the sort of number of people you had in the business, the sort of structure, and what were the key roles that you had to either develop someone into or bring in from the outside to free you up so you could completely step away from the business and have something that wasn't all about Joel Sledding?
So about 4 years in, it became very apparent that we desperately needed someone working full time in the organization. This is when you need like a controller, you need a operations manager, you know, you need all of it. I was quote unquote one of the top producers for the business, but I had replaced myself through developing other business units, other desks. Yeah. And so I passed, sort of passed my desk off to someone else, to a certain extent, but really got into acting as a CEO of business and brought in a CFO, not full time, but brought in a controller, and made sure we were brought up an operations manager, and started to really, you know, like I said, about 4 years in, start to structure the company to again scale again. And you have to have all of those processes in place and how data is going to work, and I built out a marketing team in-house, and wow. it was probably the best decision that I've ever made in business, was to bring marketing in-house and hire, you know, full-time. We ended up with 4 people on that team at our peak, and they were responsible for 65% of new business coming in the door.
Wow.
And that's how efficient they were.
Amazing.
And yeah, it is amazing, but they have, you know, they were most of them were from the University of Oregon, but they had, you know, gotten degrees in marketing, you know, and it has a lot to do with social media and all that. And they brought all that to the table, and especially my first hire, Shannon, was just absolutely brilliant at it. And we would go to market with all your standard social media stuff and email marketing campaigns and all that stuff. We were doing it constantly, and it went from being very little to being the number one business development tool for the whole company.
Do you know what? I would love to talk to you again, Joel, because that, I feel like that in itself could be a really interesting topic to explore further. And I've only just discovered that like towards the end of our call. So I'd love to hear more about that sometime. But you developed yourself and stepped up into the true CEO role. You had a leadership team in place to run operations, finance, marketing. So you really professionalized everything. I think that is the key. There's a firm I worked with over here in Europe who the 3 founders were able to scale and grow to about 140 people with offices in 4 countries. And at every stage, they replaced themselves. So they were started out billing, they replaced themselves with billers. Then they were the sales managers, and then they, you know, billing managers effectively. Then they replaced themselves in that role by, again, constantly coaching. You mentioned that that's another topic we haven't really delved into, is the coaching aspect. They coach people to upskill them so they could become managers. And then they were the directors managing managers. And then they developed people who are managers into directors. So now some of the guys who I trained when they were recruiters are now group managing directors, managing like 60 to 80 people. The three founders are completely hands off. So it's amazing, but you have to really set out with that in mind, I think. Wow, this has been such an interesting, insightful conversation, Joel. Thank you so much for making the time for this. Listen, if people want to learn more about Innova People and what you're doing and get involved, then what's the best way for them to reach out to you?
Yeah, I mean, you can always email me just at joel@innovapeople.com. And just let me know that you heard the podcast. And if you have questions, yeah, feel free. And, innovapeople.com website too.
Awesome. Well, look, let's say to be continued, because, you know, I'd love to hear what you have plans for Innova, and also more about how you leveraged marketing in a way. I feel like the search and staffing industries are very immature in terms of marketing, and it's a very sales-driven business traditionally. And so it sounds like you found something special there that I'd love to learn more about. So in the meantime, Joel, have an awesome day, and I'll look forward to speaking again.
Yeah, thanks again, Mark. Appreciate it.
Awesome.